The Lord of the Rings, and with Rowling's Harry Potter. There's so many people that are, you know, studying this stuff to see what are the hidden meanings here in this one, what are the hidden meanings in that. You know, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but one of the authors is still alive. You can talk to her. And the other author wrote enough about what he was getting at that you could read his letters and find out what he was getting at. So it's just like Lucas with Star Wars. You know, when I tell people that Star Wars was a movie to introduce Hinduism and Eastern thought to America, and I'm not saying don't watch it, but you know, that's what it is. But when people deny that, I say, well, fine, and you disagree with Lucas, because that's what Lucas, that's the reason he gave for producing the epic Star Wars. And then that's all Pappy's is saying. So, look, you know, I don't dispute about what's being written. I don't get into the debates. You study it. I just go and talk to the authors themselves. Okay? And so, obviously, this guy, you know, and what's really interesting, too, is that Eusebius gives this quote in Ecclesiastical History. And it's Ecclesiastical History, the oldest history, recorded history of the church, with the exception of the book of Acts that we have today. Yet, on one page, he says, you know, Papias says, look, I don't get into disputes and try to study and figure out for myself what they said. I go right to the sources, the authors themselves. Right after that, he then talks about how Papias has, on the very next page, was a man of a small mind, because he ever wasn't influenced by Neoplatonic thought of the Alexandrian school type. Because Papias actually taught that Jesus would come back and reign on earth and would eat food with us and would reign in the flesh. And so the thing is, exactly, he wasn't a man of high enough training like Eusebius. Well, it's like, hold on a second. Eusebius is acting like, you know, Papias was premillennial and thought Jesus would literally reign on earth, and that was a problem with him because he wasn't trained in Neoplatonic philosophy. But you just got Eusebius, you just got done quoting this guy that whenever he came across a passage that was in dispute, he'd go to the authors. This guy was a pupil of the Apostle John. I think he had a better idea what John meant in Revelation chapter 20 when he said that Jesus would reign on earth for 1,000 years and the church would reign with him. And so, you know, the idea that that Papias just, you know, literally interpreted that and, you know, never asked the apostles, do you mean, is this literal here? He's going to literally reign on earth? You know, and it just seems to me that Papias would be in much better position to know what John meant than Eusebius, especially since he wasn't wearing Neoplatonic sunglasses that colored everything he viewed. Now, Papias also said this, and it's quoted in Eusebius' Ecclesiastical History as well. And the elder said this also. He's talking about the elder John. Mark, having become the interpreter of Peter, wrote down accurately everything that he remembered, without, however, recording in order what was either said or done by Christ. For neither did he hear the Lord, nor did he follow him. So Mark wasn't one of the original, even 70 disciples. But afterwards, as I said, attended Peter, who adapted his instructions to the needs of his hearers, but had no design of giving a connected account of the Lord's oracles. So then Mark made no mistake, while he thus wrote down some things as he remembered them, for he made it his one care not to omit anything that he heard or to set down any false statements therein. So he's basically saying that Mark, being the servant of Peter, for lack of a better word, he basically recorded Peter's gospel. In fact, there's evidence that the Gospel of Mark was originally known as the Gospel of Peter, but then once John Mark got a real big name in the church and Peter had died, because John Mark was the one who actually wrote it from his notes or his memory of what Peter told him, then it became known as the Gospel of Mark. Whatever the case, I believe Papias also goes on to say that he recorded it after Peter left Rome, which was about 44 A.D. So the idea that Peter departed there, that means after Peter died, when he went back to Rome, about 67 A.D., Carson P. Thede, the British expert on ancient fragments, says that the Greek word for departed there is never used in a symbolic sense and never means death unless the context demands it. And all the context demands is that Peter and Mark were in Rome. Peter left Rome. Mark wrote down the gospel that Peter told him. So you're talking 44 A.D. for Mark. Crazy thing is that the early church, the reason why the Gospels came down to us, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, is because it was their understanding that Matthew wrote first. So our New Testament critics today, even conservative scholars that argue that Mark came first, the weight of history is against them. And John Wenham's work, where he dates Matthew's Gospel to the 30s A.D., Mark to 44 A.D., Luke to the 50s A.D., probably the mid to late 50s, and John's Gospel, you would probably agree with the about an 85-90 A.D. date. That, I think, is much closer to the truth than some of the dates that are given today. He also says about Matthew, he says, so then Matthew composed the oracles in the Hebrew language, and each one interpreted them as he could. We not only have the writings of Papias quoted in Eusebius, but then Eusebius comments on, paraphrases, other things that he wrote. And when you pull these all together, it's just amazing the information that comes out. But apparently, Matthew wrote his first gospel, the first stage of his gospel, in Hebrew. And then Papias tells us, but he later translated it into Greek so that the Gentiles, and that's probably did that around 42 to 44 A.D. when the apostles were being persecuted and had to flee Jerusalem. Okay? Now you need to put the gospel into Greek. But he refers to the first stage of his gospel as the oracles, kind of like the proclamations or the statements. And that's why I really think that, if I were God, and if I was God and I was going to become a man and teach 12 guys, one's a traitor, but teach them over a period of 3.5 years, I'm going to appoint one guy to take notes. And Matthew, as a tax collector, would probably be the leading candidate. So I think that what these guys are calling the Q document, there could be the sermons of Jesus as recorded by Matthew, which would have been written when Jesus was giving the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew was recording it right then and there. But then when he translates it into Greek, he realizes, hey, now I'm going to be preaching the gospel, preaching about Jesus to people who weren't in Palestine and don't know the events of the life of Jesus. So he added to the words of that Jesus taught the events for the background of the life of Jesus. He would have had more knowledge about the proper chronology, proper timetable of Jesus' life, the events in Jesus' life. He would have had more knowledge of that than Mark, who wasn't an eyewitness, but he probably wouldn't have had any more interest in getting that exactly right. So in other words, Matthew and Mark, the chronology was not the chronology of events was not the main emphasis, as Papias mentioned about Mark. With Luke, that's probably why you see Luke writing in Luke verses 1 to 3 when he's writing to Theophilus that, hey, you know, there's a lot of bogus gospels out there, you know, besides the good ones, and I had to investigate, see what was true and what was false. And his contribution was, though, he wanted to list things in consecutive order, because that had not been the main emphasis of... it was almost like Luke had a little bit of the modern historian in his mind, whereas the other guys were more ancient, you know, just go over the events, go over the sayings. It doesn't really matter if you get everything in the exact chronological order. Is that right there in the parking lot? Or?
I gotta go.
Oh, okay, hey, God bless you, man. Now, it was Alan?
Andy.
I knew it started with an A, so I got doing pretty good. I think that's all we'll do for the Apostolic Fathers. Now what we'll talk about a little bit, we got some time, good. What we can talk about a little bit is get into the ancient secular writings that also confirm the message of the early church. Now, before we move on, let's just take a look at this orange piece of paper. Make sure you hold on to that, because that's not in the notes, and that kind of updates the scholarship, where New Testament scholarship today is the evidence for Jesus' resurrection and the evidence for Christ's deity. So we'll cover that in probably next week or the week after. Well, actually, next week is the IBD dinner. So if you got some friends you want to invite, get them there. And
I think my friend Chris and Francis
will be there. Oh, that'll be dynamite.
7 o'clock evening.
Yeah, 7 o'clock Friday evening, Friday, February 1st at JJ's Diner. Yep. Okay, and that's the year 2002. For anybody who's listening on audio cassettes, so. Well, it'd be to be on Friday, another February 1st. I don't know how many years I'm gonna have to go by before.
8 years, probably.
Yeah. So. Now the ancient secular writers, obviously, since they're secular, that means they didn't believe. Okay, so these are not Christian writers. At the same time, we can see what they said. It presupposes that the first generation of Christians, or shortly thereafter, believed and proclaimed exactly what we have in the New Testament today. Okay? So it confirmed the message of the early church, even though these writers did not believe that message. And what I'm reading from right now is my old professor, Gary Habermas from Liberty University, one of the world's foremost experts on Christ's resurrection. This book is entitled Ancient Evidence for the Life of Jesus, Historical Records of His Death and Resurrection. Now it's been updated and published as The Verdict. The Historical Jesus. It's been updated three times with three different titles. It's The Historical Jesus. It's published by College Press. And so it's updated, and he's got he refutes Michael Martin, the guy that I debated from Boston University, his view on Christ, because Martin not only wrote Atheism, a Philosophical Justification, but he also wrote the case against Christ, or the case against Christianity, whatever. And
CBD again.
Yeah, they probably have the historical Jesus. If not, I've got in it. They've got the 1-800 number from College Press. You could order it directly from me. Hey, College Press looked at my two earlier books, and were actually thinking of publishing them, but they just decided that. They already had published books. See, they only published like 2,000 a shot. So they're not like a big, big publishing house. But with scholarly books, those are the publishers you look for. Because, you know, your big guns have a corner on the market. And so, you know, you usually just go for whoever's willing to put in print scholarly works, since they don't usually sell that much. But he's got it in the... And a little interesting story about Habermas. You know, since he was my professor, we got to be good friends over the years. And but I called him up one day to get some information on the Shroud of Turin, because he wrote two books on the Shroud of Turin, one before the carbon 14 dating, one after. And so we were talking on the phone, and I said, "Yeah, I got your latest book." And he's got a heavy, he's got a deep voice, but he's got a heavy Detroit accent. And he's the hockey coach. He's a bear of a man. Looks like a lumberjack. And so I said, "I got your latest book, Doc." And he said, "The Stroke of Jesus." I'm thinking, the Stroke of Jesus. You know, I'm thinking, it's what it is. When I left Liberty, this guy went nuts or something. You know, the Stroke of Jesus. So I was thinking, you know, I wasn't going to say that to him, but I said, no, I didn't get that one. But that sounds real good. And then so he said, "What'd you get?" And so I said, "Well, I got the historical Jesus." And he said, "Yeah, that's what I said, the Stroke of Jesus." So he's got like a real heavy Detroit accent and all. And, when I met him at Liberty, too, it was really interesting because I walked into his office and I just couldn't wait to meet this guy. You know, read so much of his stuff, now I'm at Liberty and taking his courses, but I figured I just need some one-on-one time where I could really drill him with some questions and get some real good information here. So I asked him some big philosophical question, and he's looking at me, and I got done my question, and he looked at me and he said, "You like sports? You like sports, Phil? You look like an athlete. You like sports?" And all of a sudden it dawned on me, this guy is like suffering from total burnout. You know, Jerry Falwell's working him real hard, and in his free time, at that particular point, the last thing on earth he wanted to talk about was anything job-related. And so it was kind of like the first couple of weeks was nothing but just talking sports with him. Just because he needed a break and stuff. And I was thinking, man, it's like, that'd be like, you know, finally you get a chance to meet Plato. And you go all the way over to Athens, you meet with Plato, and all he wants to talk about is the Olympic Games and wrestling. You know, it's like, bummer, big time, you know? But it paid off, because we became good friends and went out to eat a few times. And then over the years, you know, we've had some real, those big theological, philosophical discussions that I always wanted to have. It was interesting, too, because the first time that he came, I asked him if he could have lunch with me, and I already paid for the lunch in the student cafeteria. And he said, "Oh, sure, that'd be great." And so he goes walking there with me. Well, I didn't know that teachers weren't allowed in there. So this little elderly lady in her 70s is, you know, getting paid probably one-fifth of what he's getting paid. And he's a real famous scholar and all. And she was talking to him like a D.I. That was like her domain. Mm-hmm. And Jerry Falwell makes it real clear. If you're around a custodian, and the custodian is in his area, you know, that's his ministry from God, you know, they're the boss. And this lady, she was the boss of the cafeteria. Mm-hmm. So she gave him a big, but you know, teachers are not supposed to be in here.
Yeah, well, you know, these guys from Washington State and stuff like that, and I just met him and...
And on and on, so she gave him a list of rules. I'll allow it, but, you know, such and such and blah, blah, blah. And but really, real neat, real humble guy. Him, William Lane Craig, and J.P. Moreland are as nice, as warm, as strong as their intellects are, and as powerful as their arguments are, the lives that they live and the love of Jesus that flows from them is probably, I think, is the strongest arguments they have for the truth of Christianity, is just to meet these guys and spend some time with them. Let's take a look at Thallus in 52 AD. Thallus is writing, and find this quote. Africanus, is Christian, is quoting from Thallus, and he even cites where he got it from. And Julius Africanus is writing about 221 A.D., but Thallus was writing in 52 A.D., just about 20 years after the crucifixion. And Africanus says this: Thallus, in the third book of his histories, explains away the darkness as an eclipse of the sun, unreasonably as it seems to me. Okay? Now, so what you have here is evidence that Thallus, and by the way, this is not really disputed unless you get to real radical scholars like Michael Martin and people like that. Most acknowledge, you know, that's what you find of ancient history. Somebody else quotes them because we don't have any fragments on their stuff. And why would Africanus fabricate this when he's defending the Christian faith against opponents? It makes no sense. So whatever the case is, consider reliable. The Thallus of 52 A.D. was trying to explain away the darkness of Christ's crucifixion. So 20 years later, you have secular historians still trying to explain away the miraculous aspects of Christ's life. Okay? Now, Africanus said it was unreasonable, probably because Christ was crucified at what time of the year? Passover. And I believe in the Passover season that the moon is full or pretty close to it. And because they're using a lunar calendar, you don't get, you know, eclipses with the full moon. So I think that's what Africanus is talking about, that, you know, Thallus is just grabbing at straws. He's looking for anything. Cornelius Tacitus was a Roman historian who wrote in about 115 A.D. And he wrote this. It's in his annals in 115 A.D. Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero, so the Emperor Nero, fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much for the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind. You know, right now, Christians are viewed as the intolerant ones. So this can happen again. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. And it goes further on there, but let's just look at that. So you have Nero blaming the Christians for the fire that he set in Rome. Talks about that there was this guy named Christ. You know, this is a historian writing 115 A.D. Some of the apostolic fathers are still alive, pupils who knew the apostles. So, I mean, he's getting some pretty good information. He has sources before that. Some early church fathers wrote about the Acts of Pilate, of Pontius Pilate, his recordings and all. But by the way, earlier I mentioned the Gospel of Peter. That was the Gospel of Mark was originally known as the Gospel of Peter, but it has nothing to do with the pseudepigraphal false writing, the Gospel of Peter, which is written by Gnostics. But whatever the case, he confirms that Christ was put to death under Pontius Pilate. He refers to Christianity as a most mischievous superstition. So he admitted that there were supposedly, you know, there were claims to the supernatural. So it doesn't sound like Jesus was just a sage or a philosopher. There were some supernatural claims there. But it was checked for the moment at Christ's death, but then again broke out in Judea, but even in Rome. And he says Judea, the first source of the evil, so he admits it started in Judea, the southern region of Palestine, but then when it spread to Rome. Let me ask you this. What is he talking about? It was checked for a moment, the growth of the church was checked for a moment, and then all of a sudden, boom, after a small interval, it spread throughout Judea and all the way to Rome. How long was that interval?
About 40 days.
Just add 10 to it, 50 days. Because 40 days of Christ's appearances, and then Jesus said, now just wait in Jerusalem for the coming of the Holy Spirit. And then, so basically, you got like 50 days of silence, and then boom, it spreads all over. And this guy's arguing against Christianity, and he's actually adding credibility to it. They talked about people had to plead guilty to being Christians before they would be arrested. So you could deny the faith, but those who didn't deny the faith, they were put to death in very, you know, horrible ways. By the way, he says that Christ was put to death under the reign of Tiberius. Tiberius reigned from 14 to 37 A.D. We now know Pilate reigned as governor from 26 to 36 A.D. So, you know, you're putting it right in there. This is the 60s A.D. when Nero set the fire to. So, I mean, this is some really ancient evidence there. Suetonius, another Roman historian, he was writing from 117 to 138 A.D. And let me see, he says, because the Jews at Rome caused continuous disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he expelled them from the city. And this is basically a large Jewish community in Rome during the year of 49 A.D. were banished from the city because of a wave of riots. And he said it was instigated by some Crestus. And basically what it sounds like is that within the Jewish community, because the Romans, the early Romans considered Christianity as just one branch within Judaism. So they're saying there was this riots among the Jews because of this Christ guy. Okay? Again, it's really consistent with what we find in the New Testament. Second reference from Suetonius that Habermas quotes, after the great fire at Rome, punishments were also inflicted on the Christians, a sect professing a new and mischievous religious belief. So after the great fire at Rome, so there you're talking the 60s AD, they already had a religious belief, and it was considered new and mischievous. So, you know, again, how do you remove the supernatural elements and say that this stuff really came down, this persecution? Pliny the Younger was a Roman governor, was writing to Emperor Trajan in 112 AD, and so we've got what the Emperor Trajan said and what Pliny the Younger said in their correspondence. Okay. Yeah, we'll be wrapping it up in just a couple minutes, so you're not going to miss that much, and it'll be on tape. So, okay, Pliny the Younger said this, the Christians, were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day before it was light, but they was that a Sunday, okay, when they sang in alternative verses a hymn to Christ as to a God. So he's saying the way we worship our gods and sing hymns to them, that's the way they were singing to this Jesus. They were worshiping him as God. Now he's saying this in 112 A.D. Okay? He's characterizing them by this. So this is something that's probably been known for years. It says, and bound themselves by a solemn oath not to any wicked deeds, but never to commit any fraud, theft, or adultery, never to falsify their word, nor deny a trust, when they should be called upon to deliver it up, after which it was their custom to separate and then reassemble to partake of food, but food of an ordinary and innocent kind, probably bread and wine. Okay? So, I mean, this is confirming the worship of Jesus as God, the celebrating of the Lord's Supper, meeting on Sunday, and he said that they bound themselves by a solemn oath not to do any wicked deeds. That, you know, and so Pliny the Younger is implying, says, you know, we're getting these guys on charges of cannibalism, but they're just eating ordinary food. We're getting these guys on charges of sexual immorality, but they don't even commit adultery. So he's basically saying, you know, what's the scoop here, Emperor? You know, what are we supposed to do with these guys? Now, granted, Pliny the Younger probably held a view. You know, if these guys acknowledge an authority above the Roman Emperor, then we've got to put them to death. But that, let's not make up charges about them. But he's asking for advice on how to deal with them and all. So Emperor Trajan responds, says, the method you have pursued, my dear Pliny, and this is in 112 AD, in sifting the cases of those denounced to you as Christians, is extremely proper. It is not possible to lay down any general rule which can be applied in the fixed standard in all cases of this nature. No search should be made for these people. So he said, don't go out looking for them. When they are denounced and found guilty, they must be punished, with the restriction, however, that when the party denies himself to be a Christian and shall give proof that he is not, that he's not a Christian, that is, by adoring our gods, he shall be pardoned on the ground of repentance, even though he may have formerly incurred suspicion. So he's basically saying, hey, you know, if these guys deny Christ, set them free. So the Christians that were torn to shreds by wild beasts, that were crucified, that were stoned to death, that were killed in horrible ways, that were martyred in horrible ways, these were the Christians, people who refused to deny Christ. So, I mean, you're talking, all they had to do was deny him and they'd be set free. So that's why Tertullian said that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. That which causes the church to grow is the bloodshed of the martyrs. And the word martyr only means witness. It's just the most powerful witness was to die for Christ. So eventually martyr, the word martyr came to mean to die for your faith. And he goes on to say, information without the accuser's name subscribed must not be admitted in evidence against anyone, as it is in introducing a very dangerous precedent and by no means agreeable to the spirit of the age. So he's basically saying, you know, make sure you got good evidence that the accuser is not anonymous and that type of thing. But all they had to do was deny their faith in Christ and they would have been set free. Now you also have Emperor Trajan writing in he ruled during 117 to 138 AD, and so that's when he wrote. And he's basically saying that you need proof before executing these Christians. And he just says things like, I do not wish, therefore, that the matter should be passed by without examination, so that these men may neither be harassed nor opportunity of malicious proceedings be offered to informers. If therefore the provincials can clearly evince their charges against the Christians so as to answer before the tribunal, let them pursue this course only, but not by mere petitions and mere outcries against the Christians. For it is far more proper if anyone will bring an accusation that you should examine it. So he's basically saying, don't just, you know, if somebody just calls somebody a Christian, don't just punish them. Examine it. Look into it and make sure. And again, it rings just the same policy as Emperor Trajan, that if they'll deny the faith, you know, cut them loose, set them free. I tell you what, let's break it off there. And next week we have the IBD annual dinner, after that, the week after that, what we'll do is we'll continue evidence from the ancient secular writers. We'll read a quote from the Jewish Talmud, which was the oral teachings of the rabbis that date from 70 to 200 AD. It was written, it put down in written form after the temple was destroyed so that you could have the copies of these writings, the teachings, the oral tradition of the rabbis. So it dates back to 70 to 200 AD when these, you know, teachings, actually I think that's the date of the writings and the teachings precede that. Some of the teachings precede that.
Just the commentaries and the law.
Yeah, but they'll go into other things beyond that. Like they'll mention Yeshu and refer to Jesus as a sorcerer. And we'll talk about Lucian, the 2nd century Greek writer, and then Josephus, the Jewish historian, lived from 37 to 97 AD. We'll spend a little bit of time there because there's a big debate about his passage on Jesus. And then we'll talk about the ancient creeds in the New Testament, which predate the New Testament, but are recorded in the New Testament and teach Christ's deity and resurrection. And then we'll just deal with some additional evidences for New Testament reliability. And then from there, we'll start looking at evidence for Christ's resurrection. So, yeah, I'll... in fact, I don't know if they're... If they're still open tonight, I'll try to order them tonight, but if not, I'll try maybe tomorrow. But
yeah, it's so exciting to hear about the early church. Lucky bums. They got to see the apostles.
Oh yeah.